Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety. Every day I'm moving further.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. Every day with your hosts, David Von Strong and Leslie M. Scott Jones. And now, here's David and Leslie.
Hello! Charlottesville! It is Sunday. It is 10 o'clock. Happy October. And Mother Nature is letting us know it. It's just shit just dropped, didn't it?
Like, you know what, David? I may have to kill you.
All right. It sounds like we're off to a good start. No, I'm not done yet.
I'm just saying, jet lag is like a real thing.
See,
and it's like 4 in the afternoon for me right now.
Did I call Leslie loudest to come on to the show?
You did not, David.
No, right. No, Clinton did. Clinton sends me a Facebook message right as my vacation started. I get it right as I get to the hotel, hadn't even like opened my suitcase, and he goes, "So you're doing the show on Sunday, right?"
I don't think that was what my message was.
And this is Homegrown, your show for progressive local art on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I am David Von Strawn, a.k.a. the Devious One, a.k.a. Negro Suave, a.k.a. Black Frodo. And with me, once again, she is back in the house, the lovely, the loquacious, the lascivious, La Mademoiselle.
Ooh.
Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Yes.
So talk about it. How was Gay Paris? How was it?
It was amazing.
With your shirt on.
It was, yes.
Flexing your skills.
My shirt that I bought at the little market in the Champs de Mars. Yes, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Like, too much to tell in this couple of minutes that we have, but
No. We're talking about it because for those of you who are listening who don't know me, and that's probably everybody. I don't talk to people before the show because if I do, then I don't have anything to talk about. So Leslie was all hot with me because I didn't say nothing when I walked in.
No,
I was
like,
hungry.
Walked,
I was
like,
cold.
Right by me.
You talk
no
to
hello.
Somebody else.
Ain't
whatever.
Seen
so
you in like
I am,
2 weeks.
So I am reserving this time.
Ain't seen me
to
in 2 weeks.
Talk to you.
He just walked
about
right
your
on back.
Amazing trip.
I'm like David. He goes, yeah, and kept walking.
Why are you
like,
bringing up old stuff? Why are you bringing up old stuff?
I'm just saying.
That just happened
that
like
old
so
stuff.
Long
it
ago.
Happened like 10 minutes ago.
I was
ago.
Young and stupid back then. That was.
That oh, was, you've grown?
That was in my uneducated
you've
years.
You've grown How, since then? That's
right.
What you're saying?
No, talk about it. Talk about it.
No, it was amazing.
I want an itinerary of day-to-day happenings
okay.
of what happened to you.
All right, so...
keep in mind that we are tracked by the FCC.
My work meeting ended on Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, mm-hmm. and I went directly to the Champs-Élysées and had coffee and then walked around that neighborhood, saw the Arc de Triomphe, didn't make it to my hostel until like 11:30 that night.
And this probably goes without saying, but is Parisian coffee and Parisian like pastries like 10 times better than that of American?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay.
God, yes.
Okay. okay.
Yeah. As
just needed to hear it. From.
Yeah, there was, you know, I mean, for those of you who know me, I am a coffee connoisseur. I love coffee, and I just wanted to bring all of it back with me. I was just like, oh my God, this is so good. So like my first full day in Paris, I rode the metro and went to the Musée Rodin. Mm-hmm. And basically I had only planned to spend half a day there, and I ended up spending the whole day there because it was so gorgeous. I walked through the gardens that have the larger bronze statues that he did, and then had lunch at a little cafe right next to the museum, and then went back and went through the museum, which is in a hotel that he used to stay at, where he rented several rooms, and that was his workshop for a while. So they changed the entire hotel into a museum. So I went through that, and then they had another exhibit of topiaries. So I went through that, and then walked around the corner, literally a 15-minute walk to the Eiffel Tower, and you know, got a little cafe and something to eat and sat in the little park across the street from the Eiffel Tower and just kind of people watched for like an hour and a half.
So be honest, you told everybody you were Canadian, right?
No. Okay. No. And can I just say, can I just say,
Tunisian, actually.
The whole thing about...
No, I don't have ID.
The whole thing about French people being rude, I did not find that to be true. Not at all. Every single person that I met or talked to or asked directions from or whatever, they were sweet. They were like, "Oh, you're not from here. I'll help you."
Well, you have to do it by comparison. You're coming to France from the, you know, from America in the era of Trump. So right? It's automatically
they felt
going
sorry
through.
For me. Oh, you poor thing.
No,
it's okay. No.
Actually, you know what it was? It's just because they were unbelievably smug because they're like,
I know, right? Yeah.
We beat our Trump.
Well,
we're sitting here with our neoliberalist. You guys screwed up.
Some of them, nobody smiles. It's interesting. Like, nobody, like, walking down the street, they don't, you know how in the U.S., you know, you walk down the street and you,
well,
you
nuclear
know,
war
like
is on the
little,
brink. There's nothing
smile
to smile about.
Of, oh, hi, you're another person in the world kind of thing. Mm-hmm. No, that does not happen in France. Mm-hmm. They're just like, why are you looking at me? Like, I've got somewhere to be. You know? Leave me alone.
So it's like New York, basically.
It's a lot like New York. But I mean, yeah, I had a wonderful time. I went and did an entire day in London. I spent an entire day at the Globe Theatre in London. There are no words for how amazing it was to be in that building and see two of my favorite Shakespeare plays. I saw Lear at 2 and had dinner at the Swan restaurant, which is right next to the Globe, and then went back at 7:30 and saw Much Ado About Nothing.
And I stayed in Charlottesville and struck your set. But that's okay
because the last weekend of Jitney sold out every single freaking show.
And let's talk to our guests.
Okay.
Speaking of shows. Segue. a wonderful person came and saw my show. Her name was Boomi Pedersen, and she's been an avid supporter of the world of David Strawn, and I appreciate that. Actually, I've seen Boomi more this week than I've seen you, which I think is interesting.
Okay,
never happened.
We just talked about 7 minutes. I was out of the country.
No, I just thought it was very interesting. Boomy's in the house. Boomi Pedersen, Chris Ballmer's in the house, and Kiri Gardner's in the house. They're talking about A Delicate Balance going down at Live Arts Theater starting October 13th and going to November the 11th. How y'all doing?
We're doing just fine. Happy to be here. Wish we were in Paris.
Yes,
I know.
That's
what happens when somebody talks about their awesome
trip.
Really, it's like, wow,
some good Parisian,
I really wish I wasn't
right about now.
Oh my God. And the croissant. Okay, anyway. Sorry.
We can go on for
an
hour about the Parisian
croissant. I'm going to digress into the food, and we can't do that.
All I hear when I think about is France is, Molly, the baguettes, hurry up! And then that's the only thing I hear.
That's all you got?
Right from the moment when I met her, saw her, I said she's gorgeous, and I vowed.
Deborah Arnstein's watching on Facebook. Hey, Deborah!
Hey, girl!
She said, hey.
Live arts in the house. Goes, I said, live arts in the house.
With all the eyes after.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell us the plot of A Delicate Balance.
Go ahead, Chris.
Wow.
Right. What happens?
It's an Edward Albee play.
Yeah, I know, which means nothing happens.
It starts and then it ends.
There is a family. Uh-huh. Me and myself and our lovely daughter, Kiri.
A reasonably happy family.
And Agnes, who is Bumi's character's sister, who has a bit of a drinking problem.
But she's not an alcoholic.
No.
And we have neighbors who are our ostensible best friends, who we see at the club and, you know, we spend time with. And really the plot of the play involves, one, our daughter coming home because she has split from her fourth husband.
Unexpectedly.
And our neighbors show up and have some trouble, rather unexpected trouble and kind of surprising trouble. And the rest of the play is really everyone reacting to that.
It's a three-act play, by the way.
Whoa. Two bathroom breaks.
No. Oh, it's actually been split in the middle of the second act because the first act is after dinner one day, the second act is before dinner the next day, and the second scene of the second act is after dinner the next day, and the third act is the next morning. So it's split right at dinner. So the audience will be allowed to go out and have dinner and come back for the second. I'm kidding. So
everybody's coming back.
All right. Revolutionary. So it's Wagnerian is what you're saying.
So Chris, you mentioned Edward Albee. I'm not really that familiar with his work. What makes it? What makes his work so complicated? And what makes
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Virginia Woolf.
Which he won a Pulitzer for before he wrote A Delicate Balance, which he eventually also won a Pulitzer for.
Yeah. It was a Pulitzer.
So he kind of made a splash with Zoo Story, his one-act play, and then Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is revived all the time. Then A Delicate Balance, which was first produced in 1966, and then has gone on to write all kinds of
other
plays.
Three Tall Women, the play about the baby, both of which were done at Live Arts.
As was Virginia Woolf.
As was
The Goat.
As was The Goat, or Who is Sylvia.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
There's a lot of history of Albee. Actually, at Live Arts, which is kind of interesting.
What makes his work so dope? And what makes him so like Pulitzer worthy? I'm sorry. Yeah. I can sing you like every Disney musical, but I know virtually nothing about Edward Albee.
Albee is an incredibly articulate, literate writer, and he writes about, in the tradition of Pinter and Beckett and all of those existential, what is life? What are we doing? He comes out of that impulse. And what's interesting about A Delicate Balance to me is that Pinter's play, The Room, was his experiment about the terror that lies outside of a room, outside on the other side of a closed door. So Edward Albee opens the door and lets that terror in. So it's a really interesting continuum.
And his language, his use of language
incredible.
Is fabulous. And he is very articulate, but his ability to sort of, in a heightened theatrical way, create a language of very articulate people being somewhat inarticulate, mm-hmm. which is trying to address problems that it's hard to find words for. Hmm. And these are people who have a lot of words mm-hmm. and know how to talk.
It's a very wordy play.
Mm. It's interesting to hear you describe this particular play about that. Do you think that's consistent of Albee, the idea of bringing the demon inside or exploring the demon that is inside? It seems for what I know of Albee, consistent in a bunch of, and frequently it's the demon inside that disrupts and at the same time figures the domestic the domestic circle, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and it's also a matter of what we choose to talk about. A lot of how one maintains any kind of balance in one's situation and with the people one knows in the world is what we don't say. And when people start saying things that they usually don't say, that's when things go sideways.
Isn't that a traditional, like, because I've seen a lot of plays that do that, not just from the artists that you mentioned about, but it'll always be like, it'll open like this normal, regular life between maybe husband and wife or like brother and sister, and they just seem like normal people, and then somebody comes through the door, and then wackiness ensues. Isn't that kind of like
that is what drama, it's the interruption of the status quo and the resolution of it, which brings a new kind of stasis or a new status quo.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that Albee like coined that or perfected that to some degree, or is it like?
Well, yeah, I think he among several playwrights of his generation probably explored it in modern terms. I mean, now, since then, you have any number of people that have written a version of what I like to call the dinner party from hell play.
Mm. That's right.
Four people having dinner and it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
But he, before a lot of other people, he sort of explored that. I mean, you look at Virginia Woolf, which you know. But they're at each other. They're at each other's throats
from
right
the
from the
beginning. From the very beginning.
Yeah, and it just gets worse and worse. And
everybody drinks a whole lot.
And that's another play that's simply one long evening of two couples getting together.
So we have a question from our Facebook live feed. Deborah wants to know if there will be a point to discuss the recent Edward Albee brouhaha.
Which we have talked about on the show about his standards.
Let's put it that way of how his shows are supposed to be performed and casting and all of that.
This particular play is set very distinctly in a certain economic class and a certain social milieu, and that's part of the point of the play. That whole way of living is passing, and that's part of what everybody is grappling with, that their place in the world as they understood it is maybe not necessarily relevant anymore. And I think that it, more than his other plays, that element is very much a part of it. And it's also it's interesting to talk about whether you could cast that play unless you set it now. And that's the interesting thing about it. It was written in 66, but the setting, when you look in the script, is now, the present. So theoretically, you could move it into now. Some of it would be really dated, the references, but the themes would still be relevant.
And let's talk about that. We got to pay some bills. We're going to come right back. We're going to talk about if you can do Albee now instead of 66, which is, or yes. I mean, that's just me, though. This is Homegrown. Drop! 18 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. As you can see, the conversation just continues to roll no matter what. I'm David. That's Leslie. Clinton on the boards. We got Boomy Pedersen, Chris Ballmer, and Kerry Gardner in the house talking about A Delicate Balance, played by Edward Albee, going down at Live Arts October 13th through November the 11th. We were just talking about Mr. Albee and his standards. And
yes,
what
his standards
and what and how he and his playwriting group that have outlived him feel that his plays.
Ooh, David.
I believe it is the Albee estate.
Yes, it's the estate. It's the estate.
People that are still living. Not dead yet. How they feel about it. Boomy, you were mentioning that about the relevance of that actual statement that in terms of how anything should be revived or, you know, or taken to a different
you just did two August Wilson plays.
Right.
Those are very specifically for actors of color, right? And that's what August Wilson stipulated. In fact, he and Robert Brustein had this huge argument about whether even a white director could direct an August Wilson play.
This is true.
And August Wilson said, no way.
And also how August Wilson, like, kind of objected to the thought of having, like, a black Hamlet or anything, like, almost to the point, like, if... you know, if white
see,
people,
I think a black
you know,
Hamlet
if,
would be
if
really
white people don't, well yeah,
too.
But he, August Wilson said kind of to the effect like, if white people don't want black folks to be in their, you know, plays, why should they?
Right.
You know, screw them.
But I do think there are certain plays that, like, try doing a Gurney play with a diverse cast. I think it would fall on its face, but that has to do with its sort of WASP, absolute WASP milieu. But I think. And I don't know, you guys, Kerry, jump right in.
Yes, Kerry.
Well,
I'm going to get her in. She's like, can you give me the most, like, the hardest, most controversial question? Right.
Test.
I think for this particular play, A Delicate Balance, a lot, I think you can find the universality.
That is a good word.
In a lot of shows, and I think one of the ones in this particular show, A Delicate Balance, is it's sort of the danger and the safety that people find within their own family. And I think you can do that with any cast of people. Yes, specifically this play was set in the 60s with a upper middle class or upper class family, but if you do move it forward, or I don't even care if you keep it in the 60s, those themes of family and that idea that they're always going to be there, but maybe they're not always going to be there because you all hate each other somehow, or you know, that can happen with any cast.
Hashtag family.
Hashtag family.
It was really interesting watching Jitney. I actually, and the same with Fences, there are so many universal themes in those plays.
Indeed.
And
mm-hmm.
a lot of them were resonant with what's going on in Delicate Balance in totally different worlds, mm-hmm. which just goes to this sort of possibility of theater to bring people together instead of dividing them.
Yeah.
And I think this whole Albee brouhaha about yes, no, black, white, all of that mm-hmm. is so divisive. Let's come together and talk about how we can actually work together.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly things would be jarring in terms of milieu and anachronism and that sort of stuff, but I think you work with that.
And, sorry.
No, I just think... I think just as words evolve and over time their meanings change, I think theater has to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. It has to evolve to where the society is at the time it's being done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as long as it's respectful to the playwright's original intent, I don't see a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think personally what we were trying to do with Jitney is to not necessarily... exemplify the black culture, but to humanize it.
Yes.
And
to
make it timeless for anybody that was coming to see the performances.
Yep.
You know, regardless of, you know, the words and, you know, the phrases that we use. Like, these are just people, regardless.
Yeah.
Stories about, you know, fatherhood and responsibility mm-hmm. and things of that nature. All of those. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All of that. And relationships.
Yes.
Learning how to love the people that you do love and, you know, coexist. I think all of those are very human emotions and situations that need to be further explored
and,
by anybody.
Well, and universal to multiple cultures.
Absolutely.
I mean, so yeah, it's, but that is the beauty of August Wilson.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
everything is.
Let's turn down the controversy
universal.
Oven, shall we? Woo, it's getting hot in here. Let's talk about more of the process. Let's talk about the rehearsal process that you guys went through in making these characters come alive and getting together. How long have you guys been rehearsing for?
Centuries.
Everything is centuries with you this morning.
Time is relative.
Since sometime back in the middle of the summer.
Mm. Yeah.
It's been actually, this rehearsal process will be in total 10 weeks, which is a long, long rehearsal
yeah.
process.
And
we've only rehearsed
4 nights a week to start, or 4 days a week.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Together? Like everybody? Or is it just like an on-call thing? Like we're doing this same?
What the usual rehearsal process is.
Usually it's 5 nights a week. Isn't that right? It's like Sunday through Thursday with Friday and Saturday off. And we would do Sunday through Tuesday, Wednesday off, and then Thursday... then Friday and Saturday off. So it was... And a lot of that had to do with availability, Kiri.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't the only one. There were lots
Shots
of
fired.
People
Some
who
people
took
worked
weeks
on
off.
Wednesday. Yeah. Oh, and our director went on vacation in the middle. And then our stage manager went on vacation.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
still waiting for my vacation. Yeah. You didn't invite me to Paris with you, Liz.
I did. I'm so sorry. There were a lot of people on that list, and I had to, like, deny all of them.
I gotcha. Yeah,
put me
gotcha.
In the bag.
This play is pretty... I mean, the neighbors you can not have there all the time, but it is kind of an ensemble play.
Oh,
so it's pretty much we've all been at almost all of the rehearsals. And given that it's a very wordy play, you know, we've been working, this cast has been off book for weeks, which is unusual in a you know, community theater rehearsal process. But that's because the play is so word dense that you can't really work on the blocking and the movement and the relationships until you have the words in your mouth.
And that's because you care about the project and you take it seriously, unlike some community groups that I've worked with. I'm not saying anything about recently. I'm really been happy about this year. I've been working with really dedicated people, but some people, especially in New York, not so much.
If you choose a play, theoretically, you're choosing the play for a particular reason. Mm-hmm. And the words of the playwright are what makes the play the play. So why wouldn't you try to say the words as the playwright? Wright wrote them.
I just absolutely.
Paraphrasing is not something I understand.
And I think I think we do have a good cast in that regard because everybody does take the words very seriously. Mm-hmm. Everybody does want to have it exactly right. And it's definitely a show that you have to take home a lot with you and really think about and work through the script and figure out where your emotional beats are and how mm-hmm. what all those words are actually saying and, mm-hmm. and how it's relating later in the play. And you have to really the thought that, you know, it some of the scenes are a lot just between maybe Agnes and Tobias or whatever, but there's a lot of talking about the other people in the show. So as the daughter part, I want to be there for the rehearsals to hear what everybody else is saying mm-hmm. about my character so that you can build it more and figure out, oh, that connects here, and oh, she said that, so that means, you know, this other thing. So you do have to be a part of the whole process the whole time if mm-hmm. you really want to make mm-hmm. Your character make sense.
Yeah, I think the thing about like great playwrights like the ones we've just discussed is like peeling back the layers mm-hmm. and just figuring out stuff through the rehearsal process. Like, oh, now he said, oh, and this goes to this. Like, oh my God, this person's a genius. And you just kind of rediscover like new things.
That's why people call me a rehearsal whore. You know, when I direct, because I love a long rehearsal process. I love to get to the point where everyone is off. Yes.
I'm not saying that badly.
It's not a bad thing. I mean, it makes the final product that much better because you've had the words in your mouth for a few weeks mm-hmm. and you've been able to put different meaning and different inflection with them and mm-hmm. play with it and mm-hmm. try things out to see if they work or they don't work or how they read to an audience. And it's the work you need to do mm-hmm. in order to produce something that's worth somebody paying $15 to $20 for. Yeah. I mean, you know, we want to produce things that are worth the money that people yeah. are paying to see it. You know, I mean, this isn't, I think a lot of people think, oh, community theater. Well, you know, they're just doing it for fun. It's like, yeah, we are doing it because we love it, but we're also doing it because we want to give you something that's worth the mm-hmm. money that you're paying yeah. to see it. And
And I think the love comes through that dedication and exploration process of actually learning about who you're trying to portray and what you're trying to create along with these other people. Because if it's like, you know, I'm just that type of individual, it's like, if you don't do it 100%, then go home.
Right. Right. But, you know, and having worked with you as an actor and, you know, now as director, yeah. I love that. No, but I love that about you. Like, I want more actors to be like that. Please come in and give me 100% every day. Please be that actor that takes the script home and studies it and asks me questions. Like, that's the most amazing thing ever. And, oh, by the way, hi, Andy. Thanks for watching. First time watching Homegrown. So, love ya.
But it's not about me. It's about the people in the building. So talk about A Delicate Balance. What do you want audiences to get out of this experience? And what do you want people to go home with thinking, ruminating about? What's the goal here in all of this? What do you want to say with the play?
We just want them to come see the play, and we'll leave that up to them what they take away from it.
Just give us your money. Just give us your money.
I would never say up front what I want an audience to take away, because that's what our work on the play is about. Hmm. And then we'll see what you take home from it.
And we are happy to have conversations afterwards with anybody that is curious. Mm-hmm. But I think that's absolutely right. You let it wash over you, and then you walk out and something has happened. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is up to you.
I do hope that we are able to engage, that we're able to grab them and hold them, because it is a wordy play, and I think we're really working hard to make sure that those words make sense and that they're communicated in a way that keeps everyone involved in the show. So if we do that, I think...
Yeah,
I think we nailed it.
There will be no emojis on on projector screens. So, sorry, kids, you're gonna have to like actually think about this.
Listen,
no,
I'm not going.
Clint's out.
Clinton's out.
You gotta listen.
You lost Clinton.
The problem is you have to listen, and that's a real challenge for a modern audience. It's a challenge for our culture right now to really listen and hear what's being said and invest the time. But you know, you paid for the ticket, you might as well sit and listen to it.
Right.
And you're not going to have any choice because this show is actually being staged in the round.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're going to be
There is no escape.
Yeah, but that also presents unique movement and blocking challenges for a play that was written to be basically performed on a proscenium. More presentationally, and we're staging it in the round, so you're going to be right sort of
Which is actually really exciting. And it's also a way of bringing it out of the sort of 60s, stayed proscenium into we're still doing this and we're right here and you're right here with us.
That's awesome.
That sounds awesome. It's going down.
I love Thruster in the round.
Me too.
It's going down in the round. A Delicate Balance Live Arts Theater, October 13th through November 11th. Boomy Pedersen, Chris Bonner, Carrie Gardner, thank you so much.
Hopefully you guys come back.
Thank you guys.
And we do this all again. We just going into...
We're going right into it.
All right.
Right
cool.
into it, baby.
Here are just some of the artistic events that are happening this week. Thank you so much. Currently running now through November 26th. I should know this by heart. The American Shakespeare Center's summer / fall season featuring Much Ado About Nothing, Love's Labor's Lost, Henry VI, Part 3, by Shakespeare in the modern musical Peter and the Starcatcher, all at the Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton. And now through January 16th, Flugiru Aboriginal Art Collection presents an off-site exhibition defending the ocean. 21 works by contemporary indigenous artists celebrating the central importance of the ocean to human life at the Charles L. Brown Science and Engineering Library in UVA's Clark Hall. And today, the Batesville Markets Art and Wine Series, two things that I enjoy very much, continues with Amy McDavid's, Amy McDavid's Earthquakes and Redemption with music by David Tewksbury. Awesome, awesome, possum.
Hey, David.
That's going to be a great show. October 4th, Eyes on Art Tour engages people with Alzheimer's disease in meaningful discussions about art at UVA's Freeland Art Museum.
That's my birthday.
Also on the 4th, say what?
That's my birthday.
Say what? And also October the 4th, we have Lyle Harris. She discusses her exhibition with Passato Prossimo at Virginia Arts of the Book Center. On the 5th, the Kluge Aboriginal Arts Collection presents a lecture by Australian art scholar Ian McLean on Indigenous art. Can it be contemporary without already being modern?
What?
Can it be contemporary without already being modern? Question mark.
That's a question.
Hosted by Second Street Gallery. Also on the 5th through the 28th, the complete works of Shakespeare Upbridged, going down at GTP.
Yeah.
GTP, baby. Also on the 5th, UFA, MFA, reading series. I thought it was like a wrestling event for a minute. I was like, WCW?
UVA.
UVA. MFA.
Yes.
See, I really need to do this better. Reading series continues this week with Valencia Robin Grice and Juan Suarez at New Dominion Bookshop. Also, on October 6th, check an opening of painters Gene Sampson's stuff at the Charlottesville Writer House. Also on the 6th, First Friday Improv at Big Blue Door in Studio 20 of the McGuffey Arts Center. And on the 7th, poet Chetla Sabri leads a seminar to help poets get out of their comfort zone called Art of Recklessness. Surprise yourself at the Charlottesville Writer House. And also at Guerrilla Theater, one night only on Friday the 13th of October. St. Nicholas! One character show telling a story by award-winning Irish playwright Conor McPherson. And a jaded Dublin theater critic falls for a young actress, pursues her to London, and then starts working for vampires. You know, that typical story. Boy loves girl.
Boy pursues girl.
Boy starts working for vampires. You know, that timeless
love story.
Yeah. And for your music options this week,
music, oh my god,
music
today, the Michael Clem Trio at Stinson Vineyards at 2 p.m. Mojo Pie Glasshouse Winery at 3:30. Randy Johnston and Jonah Kane West at the Bebedero. Tomorrow, the Velvet People Collective opens for Chicago's Marvin at the Ante Room. ATM Unit featuring Jonah Kane West at Rapture October 3rd, Bob Huntington and then Travis Elliott at Fellini's. October 4th, my birthday, the Ragnarokers give you idiosyncratic blue pop introspective jazz and avant-garde disco at Rapture. I might check that out. October 5th, the Michael Ellswick Gathering at Fellini's, 502 Fossils at Dirty Nelly's. October 6th, Gina Sobel at Wegmans Food Market. Beatles tribute band Abbey Road Unplugged plays Glasshouse Winery. Faster Than Walking at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Get your indie jam psychedelic rockin' on with the Kendall Street Company at Southern Cafe and Music Hall. Shagwolf and Breakers play with Nashville's Oganali at the Antrim. Hey, Sally Rose. Love you, girl. October 7th, Jim Wave at Albemarle Cider Works, the Pollocks at Night's Gambit Vineyards, Sally Rose Band and Lauren Hoffman and the Secret Storm both play the Art Park. Oh, my
Secret
God.
Secret Storm.
That is going to be the craziest show. I mean, Sally and Lauren.
Lauren Hoffman.
Somebody got to go to that.
No, Claire's going.
Eli Cook at Rapunzel's Coffee and Books. Hey, Eli, what's up, boy?
Wow.
All Black Affair with DJ W at the Ante Room. John Dearth at Fellini's every Friday morning. The West African Drum Circle at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Every Monday, Bluegrass Jam at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Every Monday, Seafoot Weekly Open Jam at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church. Every Tuesday, the traditional Irish session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Every Tuesday, Latin Guitar Night with Miles Pierce and Humberto Sales at Bebedero. Every Wednesday, Open Mic Night at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Open Mic Night at Holly's Deli and Pub, hosted by Josh Mayo. Jazz Collective Number 9 at Fellini's Number 9. Bachata Fusion at the Ante Room, presented by the Charlottesville Salsa Club.
Boom!
DG and Friends at the Bebedero. And the Mike Krasinski and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's.
Oh my God!
Every Thursday, Lua at the Bebedero. And every Thursday, John Dearth at Miller's. All right. Woo. Oh my God, that's a long list.
That is a long list.
There's a lot of crap.
We're going to have to get some water after that. We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back with Bob Anderson. This is Homegrown. Drop!
Katie Baldwin, and you're listening to Homegrown, your show about local art on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And we are back. It is 38 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Home. You're just listening to Homegrown. If you're just listening to Homegrown, your timing is way off.
Yeah, you're late.
94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stay tuned after the show for the Sunday morning wake-up call. Woo-hoo. With your host, Dan Gould. Their guests are Kim Wilkins, Jessica Ote, and Elise Kane from Charlottesville Women in Tech, talking about encouraging more girls and women and femmes to pursue careers in technology. Big important show.
That's awesome.
Going down today.
All right.
But with us right now, but first we have,
oh my God,
we have a man that knows how to draw himself a woman.
Now that's an interesting way to put it, David.
He is featuring his, I guess it would be, it's not a comic book. I mean, it's a book. Would you call it a book? Just a book?
That's a catalog.
It's a catalog. This is just a catalog for the stuff that comes in large stage form
that you can
pick up and buy if you got that dough. The catalog of the category of work is called exhibition is called Les Demoiselles, also known as the Maidens or the Young Ladies. Of course, Leslie would know that better than me. At the Sarah B. Smith Gallery at the McGuffey Arts Center. Open last Friday?
Nope. Opens Tuesday.
Tuesday. See, I got question marks right here because we don't know either. So
that's
thank
fine. You guys are
for
doing
clearing
great.
That up. Bob, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. And thank you for waking me up.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing... Coming in here,
is what we do.
This is it. Yeah.
This is what we do. We are the anti-NPR, as I would like to call it.
Yeah.
We get people up and going on their Sunday.
This stuff is amazing, Bob.
It really is.
Serious. I mean, it's breathtaking, the detail that you, I mean, down to strands of hair.
The precision.
And, you know.
The muscles in the
folds
back.
Folds in skin. And your backgrounds are so intricate.
Well, should I explain that to you?
Please. Please.
Okay.
No, we don't have any time for that.
Okay. You two just go back to
what are you doing here?
Go back to. I don't know.
Please explain it.
We do life drawing at the McGuffey Art Center three times a week. Actually, it's four. Mm-hmm. They do it on Sunday, but on Sunday the model's clothed, so I don't count them really. let's see, I guess it's Wednesday night, Thursday morning at 10, and Saturday morning at 10. There's a life drawing group. It's open to anybody in the public. The sessions take place in a sculptor's studio in the basement of the mm-hmm. McGuffey Art Center.
Gotcha.
And the sculptor has lined the walls with mirrors. He's also dispersed amongst all the mirrors fragments of some of his own sculptures, just a collection of crazy stuff that he's found various places. So one day I'm sitting there drawing, and I had just finished reading the biography of Picasso. And I looked over, and I'm very frustrated because I don't have time to draw all the details of these reflections. And,
right.
And I looked at the reflections, and I thought to myself, I wonder if Picasso didn't look at a bunch of reflections in mirrors when he dreamed up the idea of cubism.
Yeah.
So that sort of stimulated this idea. And I wanted to get all that detail into a drawing, but I couldn't do it there in a 10-minute session.
Right.
So I asked one of the models if she'd like to pose for photographs. So she did. I took the photographs, and from those photographs, I was able to compose these drawings, which some of them are 4 feet long, by the way.
Right.
Doing that, I was able to get all the reflections in the mirrors, all the details. Some of the drawings took as much as 4 months to do.
It looks like that.
Now,
I was just about to ask, how long does it take?
When you look in the mirrors, you not only see the reflection of the model, but you see what's in the back of the studio. You see, you see the other artist stands. So in my imagination, I thought, oh, I'm going to put Picasso's first cubist painting mm-hmm. back there, which was Les Demoiselles d'Avignon.
Mm.
That's why I called this Les Demoiselles. I was thinking Les Demoiselles Charlottesville, but somebody told me that was a little too much. So
yeah,
I just,
it doesn't have the same ring to it.
Yeah, no, Les Demoiselles worked out fine.
So are these all pencil, or are they a combination of pencil and ink? Or?
Some are pencil, some are ink. It's a rapidograph pen.
Wow.
It's a mechanical pen. The one you're looking at now is the only male in the collection.
And a beautiful male he is.
He was an athlete. He's from Nigeria. And as it turns out, I lived in Nigeria for 6 months. So when I did his drawing, I set it up with my own art collection of things that I traded with artists while I lived in Nigeria. So the background there is filled up with a lot of my stuff from my collection. But I also put in some of the bronze pieces that the British stole when they originally arrived in Nigeria and destroyed the culture of Benin, the Kingdom of Benin.
Okay.
And I don't use any of the models' names for obvious reasons. There have been cases of models being stalked.
Yeah.
So we're very careful about that. Mm-hmm. So in this book, or in my show, I use code names occasionally. I use names of goddesses. One of them is Venus, and when you look at her, you know why I call her Venus.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of this particular drawing that you're looking at, one of my favorite books by T. Corrigis and Boyle is called Water Music, which takes place in Nigeria. So I put my copy of the book down there, and the drawing is called Water Music.
Yeah. Mm. I am absolutely amazed at not only the detail, but especially in the one I'm looking at, the tiny figures in between the model's legs. Like, I mean, yes, they're tiny figures, but you can actually make them out as people. One's a skeleton, and I mean,
if you're looking at the little tiny ones, some of which are diving off the mirror in the background.
Yes, yes.
Those were called jujus. Now, a juju in French, juju is play. It's a toy. It's a toy. So we think that because of French influence in some of the colonies, the former colonies in Africa, the term juju came about. Then somehow it got into in Haiti.
Yes.
Juju has references to witchcraft, voodooism. But in Nigeria, they call these little figures, and they're all over the place. They're cast in bronze. They would call them jujus. which I think really means toys, because that's what they are. They're little toys.
Yeah.
So I brought a whole pile of them home.
Oh, wow.
I still have them. And I just sprinkled them around when I did that drawing. And then I took some of them and I had them diving off as if they were climbing up the back of the mirror and jumping off the front.
Yeah. You
know? So it really... Looking at the background and also looking at the background and looking at the figures, it's, and also with the mirrors, it's really interesting. Is it the Cubist influence, because you've got an echo of the model in the figures that you've got around, and also you've got with the reflection sometimes the fragmentation of the model, and so it's just. Yeah, so what was the thought behind that?
Well, in my personal case, the cubism and the idea of Picasso and the fragmentations in the mirrors, that's what stimulated the beginning of this process, this series. But personally, my own background, I have to say I'm eclectic. You know, I come from all over the place. I love Picasso. He was a major influence in the way I developed my art. I also liked Modigliani. I liked Michelangelo. A lot of my early figures look like Michelangelo's figures. I've never been really crazy about surrealism, but I like distortion a lot. Mm-hmm. So in some of the drawings, I've drawn the model as if the model, you can't tell if the model's in the mirror or out of the mirror.
That's exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting
because you've got
like this
nice
one.
You've got this really
right here,
yeah, that one is really, really gripping. You've got this really interesting mix of really clear and almost photographic representation, but at the same time unreality and distortion.
Exactly. Now the realism comes from the New Realism movement, which was back in the 70s. I lived in New York at that time. And I remember going to the Whitney, and I saw the very first show at the Whitney of work by Philip Perlstein, John Estes, a lot of these people who are known as New Realists.
Hmm.
And that had a huge influence on me. In fact, I went and I enrolled at Brooklyn College, because that's where Perlstein used to teach.
Okay.
I enrolled at Brooklyn College, and then by the time I got in there, he was on sabbatical. So I took some courses in anthropology and non-art stuff. Then I met my wife and I said, oh, the hell with this. I took the grant money they'd given me and I took off to Paris.
That's how you do.
After a Leslie Zone heart.
I actually worked there for since I didn't speak French at the time, I worked there as a cartoonist, and I developed cartoons with no dialogue.
Huh.
And I had my own column in an underground paper there for about a year.
Nice. The first place that I lived at when I lived in Brooklyn was right across from Brooklyn College. So, just a little thing I wanted to throw out there.
I'm glad you did.
Because I'm not an artist. I know Brooklyn College. I know about that.
Were you into the Dodgers? Were you a Dodger fan?
No. Well, no, I'm not so much.
You're too young.
We should do a drop.
Yeah, we should do a drop. But I walked by Ebbets Field like a lot of times, and that's my jam. We're going to do a drop. We're going to come right back with Bob Anderson doing his thing. This is Homegrown. Drop! It is 50 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, you missed a hell of a Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC.
Oh, my goodness.
The progressive voice of Charlottesville. God help you if you've missed this Homegrown.
Okay, so you said that you asked people to pose so you could take pictures of them to have more time to put in detail. So is that true for all of the ones in the exhibition? Because I'm looking at some of these poses, and I've modeled for people before. Holding these poses for more than 10 minutes would have been seriously painful.
It would have been impossible. And in fact, as I think I mentioned earlier, some of the drawings took 4 months to draw.
Right.
So what happened is I did the very first one. The model, I gave her a full-size print of it.
Mm.
Then I gave her a digital copy, and she put it on her Facebook page. And the next thing you know, all of her friends were calling up, and they wanted to be posing.
They wanted to pose,
they wanted
her.
To pose for the series.
Well.
Now, Picasso had, in his Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, he had five models.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to hold it to five models. Then I met a sixth one, and I couldn't resist. I finally decided to go to six. And then I thought, well, you know what? The hell with all females. I'm going to do one male. So I met this fellow from Nigeria, and he was a spectacular model. Mm-hmm. So I brought him in too. So that's the mix. In the show, I also have photographs. I have some examples of some of the photographs I took.
Mm-hmm.
A photographer at McGuffey, Ron Evans, took my photographs, and I gave him permission to crop them any way he wanted to. So some of them have been adjusted by him. So I'm calling that part of the show a collaboration.
Yeah.
And he did a wonderful job. And then I have some examples of the short sketches I did with you.
Yeah, I'm looking at those now. So these are, I mean, even the short sketches that you've done are, they have so much detail in them. I am amazed at the level of detail, even in a short 10-minute drawing.
Well, some of those are as much as a half an hour.
Okay.
But this one here,
yeah,
that's 5 minutes.
But see, even in 5 minutes, look at the shading and all of the, I mean, you can really tell body types and everything. I'm marveled because I can't draw a stick figure and make it look good. Like,
I can draw the hell out of a stick figure.
I started when I was 4 years old, so I've had a little practice.
Really? Okay.
So, and how old are you now? 25, 26?
Close. You're getting close.
All right. Just want to make sure.
So I want to see if I can get two things in before the show ends really quickly. One, we've been looking at a catalog of the exhibit, and you were saying earlier that this is the first time that McGuffey's been able to put out a catalog, and say why.
Well, we have a new art director who's got a lot of vision and a lot of great ideas. And she came up with the idea of getting, for a couple of the shows each year, to get an underwriter. So we found an underwriter for this show. That underwriter request to remain anonymous. But that person put up some money. We were able to do a catalog, to do some cards, posters. And any excess money after the show's over is going to go into a scholarship fund for people who can't afford to pay for classes or can't afford to pay for life drawing sessions.
That's great.
And sometimes we'll have a life drawing session. We pay a minimum amount to the model. Well, there are times when only three people show up. That's not enough for the model. So it comes out of the, whoever's running the show pulls it out of his pocket and pays it and hopes to make it back the next week. Yeah. So this will help cover that as well.
And that leads me into my last question, which is a more general question. So as we've pointed out in this show before, we live in a Judeo-Christian Islamic culture with serious taboos against sex and nudity. Why the importance of the nude model in figure drawing? I think that so much is our taboo that it still shocks and disturbs people today.
Well, I have to admit, when I was in college, I used to love to shock people. So, but that has nothing to do with it. That's another thing. Historically, doing the nude, it has always been a very important part of art. The nude is us. That's who we are without our clothes on. It's how we came into the world. And to understand anatomy, to understand everything about humanity, for an artist, you need to know how to draw a person. And to draw them, you need to see them all, every part of them. You need to see them moving around. Often I had the models moving constantly, so I would draw them in different positions. I've learned how to draw very quickly so that I can draw people who are in movement. And most artists can do that. Most artists who at least draw figures can do that. Okay. But to me, that's a very, very basic, critical part of art. It's part of humanity. It's part of the human race.
Yes.
We should not be ashamed of ourselves. We should be proud of ourselves.
And you've heard it from Bob Anderson first. So if you're just listening, go outside, get naked, celebrate yourself. Walk around Charlottesville. Get nude, y'all.
David.
That's what he said, right?
Dave, no, that was not.
That's what you were
that was not.
I backed that up.
Humanity, baby.
Go for it.
That's what this is about.
Oh, my God.
Dude.
Save
everybody.
Save me.
Men, women.
Save me from the testosterone in
queers
this room
and
right now.
Get naked.
Wow.
Bob Anderson, thank you so much. Sarah B. Smith Gallery, McGuffey Arts Center. It's opening this Tuesday. Get your Bob Anderson on. He's amazing. Look at his catalog.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, my God.
No, seriously, go see it. It's amazing.
Bob, thank you so much. And now, this is Leslie's Weekly Rant.
We're doing that?
Yes. Right now.
Okay.
Oh. Are we doing it?
No, we don't have time to do it.
We got time. Ran a little.
Okay. Sure.
I got to say something, but yeah.
Sure.
Can I listen to this?
Yeah. Sure. Stay, Bob. Sure.
Bob's going to get naked while you talk.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to do it from memory, basically, because I wrote it earlier. But okay. So there is something magical. There's something magical about leaving home and going someplace foreign to you. There's also something just as magical about coming back home. So I got home only yesterday from an amazing experience. And my one message to everyone, because I'm still processing. I'm still thinking about how this experience has changed me. But my one thing I need to say to everyone, go. That place that you've always wanted to visit, those things you've always wanted to see, go. Drink the wine. Soak up every ounce of that culture. No matter what it costs you, because what you get from it is so worth it and is not measurable in any monetary way. And I'm sure in the next weeks, days, months, I'll be able to process this and it will come out in different ways. But right now, all I can say is it has been the blessing of my life to walk those streets where something as simple as a doorknob is art and something as extravagant as a castle is history. And I had reaction to art in that place that I've never had before in my life. And I can't say enough about what it's done for me.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do, so is Aladdin next? You're just going to go to Agrabah and, like, celebrate that culture? Buy yourself a lamp?
Actually, I got invited to go on a road trip to Africa.
Look at you. See, that don't happen to me. Like, you should just go away with me. All right. Stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call with your host, Dan Gould. Their guests are Kim Wilkins, Jessica Otey, and Elise Kane from Charlottesville Women in Tech, talking about encouraging more girls, women, and femmes to pursue careers in technology, and also, as the feminists call it, STEM careers, which means science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's very important. It's actually stuff that I'm reading about right now. So thank you guys so much. With me always is Leslie M. Scott Jones. Thank you so much to Boomy, Chris, Kiri, and Bob Anderson for just being awesome. We got to go. This is Homegrown. Love y'all.
You've been listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.